You're on.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming. If I haven't met you before, my name is Jason Strauss. I'm the rabbi here at Kadima. And this is actually the third part of a series of shiurim, of lectures on different topics related to synagogues and the construction of synagogues and the holiness of synagogues and the use and behavior in synagogues. And one obvious topic, well, the reason why we started this lecture series, just first of all, is because we're very excited and, you know, anxiously waiting for the beginning of the construction project of our new shul. Hopefully within the next couple of years we'll have a new, brand new building. And obviously one of the major topics that comes up in that context is what is, if it's an Orthodox shul, what is the mechitza going to look like? Now, obviously, before you even discuss, if you're going to talk about mechitza generally, you're not going to start with the question, what should the mechitza look like? You're going to start with the question, why should I have a mechitza? What is a mechitza and why should I have one? Right? Why is that necessary in an Orthodox house of prayer? So, there are actually two rabbinic sources that are the main, they're pretty much the ones that are quoted by any Orthodox rabbi that has ever written about this topic, at least certainly in the last 200 years. And those are the ones that you find on the first two sources you find on the first page of the packet in front of you. So I'll read the first one without going into too much detail, and then the second one we'll try to read closer and see if we can pick out some of the different types of things that people might pull out of it to get the idea of mechitza. So the Mishnah in Midot, which is all about the measurements of the temple, so Ezra Tanashim, so the women's courtyard, which is part of it, you know, which is an outer courtyard, wasn't really just for women, it was just that not only Kohanim, but anybody in any man or any woman would be, if they were ritually pure, would be able to enter that courtyard, and that's why it's referred to that way. So, chalaka haita bereishona. So originally, it was, the walls around it were smooth, right? Vekifuha ketutzra, and then eventually they surrounded it with a balcony. She'anashim ro'ot milmalan, ve'anashim milmatan. So that women could see from above, and men from below. Kadesh lo yehu mu'uravin. So that they would not be mixed. Okay. So this, almost the same exact language is going to be quoted in this Gemara. Source 2. This is Gemara in Sukkah. It's actually one that anyone who has attended our weekly shiur on just going straight through the tractate of Sukkah on Thursday mornings. You can join us about 8 o'clock every week. We actually learned this Gemara. So it says, B'motze Yom Tov. So the Mishnah, the context of the Mishnah is talking about a celebration of the drawing of the water for the water libations that took place on Sukkot every year. So there's a big celebration that happened at the temple. And as part of the celebrations, it mentions in the Mishnah that there was a tikkun gadol, some kind of great fixture, some kind of great fixing of something. So, my tikkun gadol, what is this great fixing? Amar v'lazar, ke'ota sheshaninu, chalaka haita b'rishona v'kipua kezustra. So, this sounds familiar, right? It's like that which we learned. It was smooth originally, and they surrounded it with a balcony. And they instituted that women sit above and men below. All right, so slight differences from the Mishnah, but more or less they seem pretty similar. Okay, but then it brings another source that gives us even more detail, but is also a little different. Tanu Rabbanan. So the rabbis taught, Rishona. So originally the way they had it set up was that women were dancing in the courtyard that is entitled the the courtyard of the women, and men who were not Kohanim and were not involved in the temple service were outside. The problem was that if men wanted to come inside, they had to walk through the women. So says the Gemara. So v'hayu ba'im li dekalat rosh. So that led to all kinds of levity. So hitkinu shehu nashim yoshot mechutz v'anashim b'fnim. So then they instituted that women would be on the would sit on the outside and men would be on the inside. Okay, but there's no. So there are men on the inside, women around on the outside, but there's no separation of levels, or it doesn't mention anything about a wall specifically, just that they're separated. V'adayin hayu b'ainli dekalat rosh. And they still came to levity. So hitkinu shehu nashim yoshot nomala v'anashim omata. So then they decided that women should sit above and men below. How could they do that? So there's this pasuk in that about the first Beit Hamikdash when Shlomo built it in Divrei Yamim that makes it sound like God said word for word exactly how the Beit Hamikdash is supposed to look. So how could they suddenly build a new addition to part of the temple in order to solve this problem of men and women, having levity when they're dancing in the same area, or are in the same area when there is dancing going on? So Amar Rav, answered, Kra Ashkechu V'drosh. They found a pasuk to solve this. V'safta aretz mishpachot, mishpachot levad, mishpachot beit David levad, nishem levad. So this pasuk in Zechariah that makes it sound like at some point, there's going to be mourning, and families are going to be separated, and the families of the house of David are going to be separate, and from their meaning the men are going to be separated from the women, in this context of mourning. So Amru v'halo dvarim kal chomer. So then it should be obvious from that that in our case too there should be separation. Umala did lava. She'oskin v'hespid v'inyi tzahara sholit v'hem amra Torah anashim levad v'nashim levad. So if in the future, when they're going to be dealing with mourning, because, and the Gemara later on talks about who is it that died, and suggests maybe it's one of the messiahs, the messiah that descended from Joseph, but let's not get into that right now. So in the context of mourning, they're sad. So of course there's not going to be any levity. There's not going to be anything inappropriate going on, and yet they're supposed to be separated. So achshav she'asukim b'simcha v'yitzhara sholit b'hen. So then when there's dancing and joy and the yitzhara is much stronger, so then al kama v'kama, then certainly there should be a separation. And so that makes it sound so they inferred from that it must be that there is a divine expectation of separation of men and women, and therefore it would not be a violation of God dictating exactly what the Beit HaMikdash is supposed to look like if they were to alter it so that men and women would be separate. Okay? Having learned this, how does any of this seem related to building a mechitza or having a mechitza in a synagogue? Even just superficially.
That in joyous spiritual moments, that there seems to be a push to separate men and women, which is something that a mechitza does in a synagogue, which is it has joyous spiritual moments.
Okay, so maybe it's because in a certain context, it sounds like it's appropriate to separate men and women. Okay.
It also seems like the synagogue as we have it is a middle ground. It's not the Chomer and it's not the Kal, but still the same rules would apply because it's not a place of mourning, but it's not a place of dancing either. But since those two, we have the rule of you should be separate, so for things in the middle, you should also.
So it fits into the spectrum, so yeah.
I mean,
There also the
Oh, sorry. But whatever. Yeah, I'll get to you next.
I think there's a implicit ad levity can be bad or dangerous or whatever else. Like that this is something to active certain types of levity are something to actively avoid in this context.
Right. So it sounds like the thing that's bad is that somehow mixing of men and women leads to levity, and levity is the thing to avoid.
Right.
Yes.
If we're modeling our prayers after Beit HaMikdash practices and our synagogues after Beit HaMikdash, then it becomes relevant that historically we know it was not built with mechitzas or with, you know, this separation. So this discussion of how that came to be becomes relevant to our buildings if we're going to look at the Torah history of the building, then we're also looking at the Talmud history of the building.
So you're saying that the part that's important is that the temple did not have a separation?
I'm saying that if we know that we're modeling things in part after the Beit HaMikdash, and we know that the Torah description doesn't talk about mechitzas and separation, then this becomes an important text to discuss if we're going to have a historical discussion about what's going on.
Okay. So that's true. So in terms of the how exactly, which direction exactly we're going to take it, I'll leave that vague, but the part of that where we might think about modeling services and actually the construction of our sanctuary, the structure of it, and also our treatment of it on the Beit HaMikdash, that idea certainly makes sense. You know, this would might be a source for that, for sure.
There's also the fact that it was a certain way and then changed for pragmatic reasons is also something interesting. This is not a, there was not a, this is the ideal form of it.
This is what worked.
There was a goal of preventing something.
Right.
And then you, within that, try balconies, try whatever worked.
Right.
To accomplish that.
Right.
Not a, the separation in its own right, not a wall in its own right. That was not the goal, but that was a means.
Right. It wasn't that trying to exclude one group or the other from what was going on, as much as trying to figure out the most pragmatic solution for something they saw that was happening that they thought was inappropriate in that context. Ari, yeah.
So the source that they quote about being separate during mourning, it would seem that they're right, that at least from what they're saying about the mixing causing levity, and so that would be inappropriate for a context of mourning.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that make it wrong for other contexts?
They're saying that since in a mourning we would not expect anyone to there be any levity, right?
Yeah.
And yet they still have to be separated. They're still concerned that the Yitzhahara will have some kind of effect. So then when the Yitzhahara would exist even more somewhere else, because it's not as somber
the
environment.
Isn't the problem, at least in the English translation, it seems that the levity is the issue.
Yeah, but it's, in other words, the levity is, the kalat rosh is what you don't want to get to, between the men and women. But I guess they're saying that, I guess what the Gemara is saying is that they assumed that why would the Pasuk be saying that they had, the men and women had to be separated in the context of a funeral? It must be that they were really, really concerned about men and women mixing and this kalat rosh. So then, we have a biblical source for that kind of separation existing, even in a less celebratory, lightheaded kind of situation, so then it should be obvious that we could treat it as a biblical source, that for creating such a structure in a context that's not as somber, such as, you know, during the celebration of the drawing of the water, and so to apply that to our context, a shul is not exactly someplace that we're except on Simchat Torah and Purim, we're not exactly jumping around every single week, but it's not necessarily it's not as somber as a funeral either. It's just what it means.
Not just what it means, but maybe how the rabbis view it as an issue.
They view it as kind of like just it's an inappropriate behavior to exist in. It's the Gemara explicitly talks about it as something that's inappropriate kind of behavior on the Temple Mount and inappropriate behavior in synagogue.
But it's only in a religious context.
Yeah, it's not, what?
Does it mean evil inclination?
No, it doesn't mean evil inclination. It means, like a very much a lack of seriousness. I don't know how to, like you're just being, like kind of silly or, yeah, I guess like if we're talking about, men and women, it would be like a flirtatious kind of attitude towards each other. Rather than a serious business-like or all right, so a lot of the points that we just talked about are gonna be brought up as different reasons that various rabbis over the last 200 years have given for why mechitza exists. They all knew that it existed. They all knew that this was the source for it, but they needed to give a logic to it. In order to draw from that, what exactly are the boundaries? What is a violation of the boundary of, I guess, Orthodox halacha that we could say if a synagogue doesn't follow these rules, then it's not an Orthodox synagogue. So we'll start with one that we can dismiss out of hand because just historically it's been disproven. And it's just fascinating to look back at it. So in 1959, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who at the time was the associate rabbi of the Jewish Center, later became the rabbi of the Jewish Center, and then after that became the president of Yeshiva University and the Rosh HaYeshiva. So at that time, he was relatively young and still himself a Talmud Chacham, a scholar, in Torah, and decided to write what he thought would be a convincing modern attitude based on scholarship, modern psychological I guess you could say like based on sexual behavior, like studies on sexual behavior, using that information to write an article about why mechitza is necessary. One of the arguments he uses in it. Is something called reductio ad absurdum, which is that if you argue why we should get rid of a mechitza is X, so if you follow that logic all the way to its conclusion, then you're going to get to this absurd conclusion. So obviously, getting rid of mechitza is ridiculous. Okay, so let's see what I mean by that. So he says, separate seating, we are told, reveals an underlying belief that women are inferior. And only when men and women are allowed to mix freely in the synagogue is the equality of the sexes acknowledged. To this rallying call to chivalry, we must respond to a demand for consistency. If the non-Orthodox movements are, in this matter, the champions of women's equality, and if this equality is demonstrated by equal participation in religious activities, then why, for instance, have not the non-Orthodox schools graduated one woman rabbi all these years? Why not a woman cantor, even in reform circles? Recent attempts to introduce women into such positions have resulted in a good deal of controversy. Why are temple presidents almost all men and synagogue boards predominantly male? Why are the women segregated in sisterhoods? If it is to be equalities, then let us have complete and unambiguous equality. And he keeps going. We don't have to read the whole thing, but it's fascinating to read. He says, they must submit as well to the private obligations incumbent upon menfolk. Prayer thrice daily and betzibor, right, davening three times a day. In the synagogue, donning talit and tefillin, acquiring their own lulav and etrog, etc. These mitzvot are not halakhically obligatory for women, yet they are voluntarily practiced by solitary women throughout Jewish history. To mention but two examples, Michal and the Maid of Lomita. Okay, So we can already see how this argument doesn't work. Because if you're familiar at all with non-Orthodox movements, or even within much of Orthodoxy, a lot of these things already are just not true, right? We already know that. What?
Are true.
A lot of, well, these arguments don't make sense, I should say, because the statements he's making are no longer true, right? In other words, in Reform and conservative circles, there absolutely are women rabbis, there are women who are cantors, there are women, lots of women who are presidents of synagogues, and even within Orthodox circles, women are presidents of synagogues, women are on synagogue boards. Now there are more controversial, but it does exist that there are Orthodox rabbinic institutions for women. And so just on that argument that women are not participating enough in other areas of Judaism, so they can't demand equality, by getting rid of the mechitza, that argument simply does not hold up to the test of time. So we can reject that one out of hand. It's also not convincing at all, right? How could you say to somebody, you can't have one thing that makes you feel more equal because there's all these other ways that you're still excluded? That doesn't make any sense, right? That's like saying, I'm not going to let you have this flavor of ice cream because you still can't have any of the other flavors of ice cream. That doesn't make any sense. So we're gonna move on to ones that are more convincing. The next one, you can tell me what you think of it. But I think it's going to be an essential one. So we don't have to read the whole Rambam, but basically the Rambam in source 4 talks about, if a rabbinic law is instituted at some point in Jewish history, then the only way to undo that decree is if you get a court or a group of rabbis of equal stat, of greater stature really, and greater number, to undo that rabbinic decree or institution. And so he actually points out, well, I understand, the court is the same size every time. Sanhedrin's always 71 members. So he says you have to have, in addition to the Sanhedrin, more rabbis supporting the repeal of the law than supported it initially when Sanhedrin originally instituted it. So it has to be even more unanimous to uproot the law in the whole, among all the scholars of the generation, than it was when it was originally passed. So we'll look at the historical point that separation of men and women in Jewish houses of prayer is pretty much does go actually back to the temple period, but it's certainly something that was instituted at least by rabbis and has existed, right? So that's one issue, is that even if we don't read the rest of the Rambam, you would need a significant, if it was just rabbinic, you would need a significant, you would need a court, and you would need a significant unanimous decision by scholars of the generation to uproot it. But then the next point is crucial. He says, this is like the second paragraph, he says, "B'medvarim amurim," source 4, "B'medvarim amurim, b'dvarim shelo asru otan kedei la'asot siyag la'torah, ela kishar dinei Torah." When does this apply? When that rabbinic prohibition was not meant in order to create a protection for something that is biblical. Aval dvarim sharau beit din l'gzor, ul'asan la'asot siyag, if the whole purpose of it is to create a protection for something that's a biblical prohibition, in pashat isruan b'chol Yisrael, if it's spread throughout all of Israel, in beitin gadol acher yachol akon, then no great court, no matter how great it is, no matter how many rabbis, no matter how unanimous it is, can uproot it. So, if we do assume that let's assume that the Gemara that we quoted before, let's assume that the actual construction of that separation of men, separating men and women, let's say that the construction that they did was rabbinic, but it was trying to protect something that's biblical, and they proved that from the verse in Zechariah. So then that means it can never be uprooted, no matter how many people you got together to get rid of that institution. Rav Kook makes a not exactly the same point, but it's in the same general direction. He says, this is source 5. He wrote, he heard about the controversy in America about Mechitza, and he wrote a pretty harsh letter to the American Jewish community about the need for Mechitza. And he writes, V'nikvar bi'arnu, she'el adarim shal iser hit arvot an Hashem v'nashim b'beit ha'knesset him, yisrim chamurim shal Torah. He says the prohibition of the mixing of men and women in a synagogue is a very serious prohibition, of biblical prohibition. Chalil l'shum adam yisrael yimadot bin arvayim. And of avaryanim, and God forbid that anyone should be accounted among those who violate this law. V'liyot nitfal la'ida kazot haporetet et gidrei hakodesh halalu, and to be among the congregation that breaks this holy barrier. V'isur gamur mi'ikar hadin li'kanis litpaleil b'batei knesset ilu. And it is a full prohibition to enter and to pray in such synagogues. V'afilu im hayu hadvarim halalu asirim rab b'nei min ha'gavoteinu b'avad. But even if doing these things was only prohibited because it is a custom from our forefathers, it's not something that's from the Torah, but it's something that is handed down from practice. There are those who say that it's just a custom. It would still be a very serious violation to not have one. And the customs of our ancestors is actually the is also considered content of Torah. And he just then quotes a bunch of statements in Chazal that prove that point. So the second argument we're going to consider for why mechitza is necessary, or why at least we should continue to do it, is simply because it was instituted by the rabbis for a certain purpose. And once it's been instituted, rabbinic law can't be changed so easily. That's just, so that's, without going into the reason for why mechitza existed in the first place, it's just even if you were to say that it were simply rabbinic law is not so easily revoked. It's something to take seriously. Should be kept like any other aspect of halakha. The third reason actually has a fascinating historical background to it. So earlier I mentioned that the idea that separation of men and women in synagogues existed probably going back to temple times. I'm not just saying that randomly. So Dr. Jonathan Sarna, Bostonian, wrote an article a number of years ago about mechitza, and he said that actually separation of men and women in synagogues goes back as far as historical record shows, and actually goes back in Christianity pretty much all the way back through its history as well. Mixed seating in synagogues or churches is a very recent phenomenon. So he says that the first example of complete mixed seating in a synagogue happened in 1850. And for the most part in America, churches had been separated for most of its history, but at some point in the 19th century, the idea of family became much more central to American identity and to American values. And so this idea of family pews, that a family would sit together, right, a family that prays together, stays together, something like that, that idea became very appealing, and so churches rearranged their seating. And so there was this Reform rabbi named Isaac Meir Wise, and he was the rabbi of a synagogue in upstate New York, but I'm trying to remember where. So it was in Albany. So it was in upstate New York. In Albany, sorry. He was actually fired from his position, but he refused to accept him being fired, so he still went to services. A fight broke out. Police had to be called. He ended up having services in his home for a while until he was decided with people who broke off and supported him to start a new synagogue. And they purchased an old church that had closed down. And the church had family seating, family pews. So rather than change the family pews back to separated seating for men and women, the way that all Reform shuls were, they didn't have mechitzas in Europe or in America, Reform shuls, but they did have separate seating for men and women. Rather than do that, they just devoted to just keep it the way it is, and families will sit together. So the first ever mixed seating synagogue in the world was actually a church. So why is that? Why is that extreme? Why is that important? Why might one say that's important? So Rav Soloveitchik, in one of his letters in the 1950s, arguing for why mechitza is so essential, said, in its martyr's history of 1,000 years, the people of Israel have never violated the sacred principle. Moreover, when primitive Christianity arose as a sect in the Holy Land and began to slowly introduce reforms, one of the innovations which the sect established at once in the externals of synagogue practice was to have men and women sit together. In many instances, mixed seating was the unmistakable sign by which a Jew could recognize that he had found not a place of sanctity for Jews to pray, but rather a prayer house for a deviating sect, for in those times the Christians had not yet formally differentiated themselves from traditional Jewry. So essentially, Soloveitchik argued that mixed seating actually was what defined the difference between a shul and a church. He thought that was a defining characteristic of the difference between a Christian house of prayer and a Jewish house of prayer. Now, it doesn't sound like Dr. Sarner's article supports his idea that the mixed seating in Christian houses of prayer goes all the way back to the beginnings of Christianity. But the idea that it does come from Christianity, at least in America, that's historically true. And why is that important? Probably what he had in mind is that there's actually a biblical prohibition, called Ubichut Chukotehem Lo Telechu, that you should not follow in the laws of non-Jewish religions. So how far that goes, it depends on which rabbi you ask. Some rabbis will say you can't wear ties because non-Jews wear ties. Okay, I'm not currently wearing a tie, but that's not the reason I'm not wearing a tie. I'm not wearing a tie because, I don't know, I'm not formal enough to wear a tie every day. But you've seen me wear ties on Shabbos. But the prohibition does exist. So at a minimum, we could say that actually doing following specifically non-Jewish practices with regard to how they worship God or whatever deity, right, that would probably at least fit into the idea of not following the laws of other religions. So it's not a crazy stretch at all, I think, to say that mixed seating, if it did originally come from a context of Christianity, would, and then instituting that in shuls would be a violation of Mechukotehem lo telechu. You should not follow the laws of non-Jewish religions. And that is one of the arguments that Rabbi Lam makes in his article as well. He sort of takes what Rabbi Soloveitchik said about, you know, making the shul into mixed seating is Christianizing the shul, and he says, he just spells it out. He brings up Isaac Meir Wise. He brings up the fact that it was that his first shul with mixed seating was a converted Baptist church, and he says, and therefore it is a violation of the paganization and Christianization of synagogue, which is v'chukotehem lo telechu, mimicry of non-Jewish religious practice. Okay, so I actually find that to be a pretty convincing argument. Any questions so far? Yes.
Did any of the people who applied this apply it to the Devard's Torah in synagogue?
Why?
Directly taken from the Christian sermons on Sunday, on purpose by the Reform movement to make there be an understandable part of the service to draw people in. And I know there were early Orthodox synagogues that would not do the Devar from that, in that style, from that position because of that.
So why certain, I could probably give you a defense anyway of giving a Dvar Torah from during shul, but if you would like us to be strict about this and no longer have a sermon, it will make my job a lot easier. So I'm happy to comply with any chumras you want to apply.
Connection between the same people and the same rabbis who said that anything that was modeled after the church service.
I am sure that was their thinking behind it. I'm sure.
Did it fall by the wayside because, as you point out, there are plenty of good Jewish reasons to do that too.
Yes.
Like the Christians had an idea.
That is, I would guess that that's exactly. I would guess that that's the case. Honestly, I didn't know that historical nugget about sermons in churches, but I did know Yerushalmi about Rabbi Meir giving a drasha on Friday night in shul. So that, like, you know, I could, you know, and there are lots of cases of, you know, things mentioned in the Gemara about rabbis giving drashot from some kind of platform somewhere and people listening to it. I'm not an expert in Midrash, but the way that Midrash has been explained to me is that it's sort of a compilation of what various rabbis have said over the generations in a similar context, where they were taking things and sort of expounding on them and sometimes making up stories in order to make a point. So
is there an underlying root here that when we talk about, oh, don't take stuff from other religions, that we don't mean that as a standalone reason, but don't take stuff from other religions that we also don't like for other reasons, that we also think don't go with our values for other reasons?
Right. I guess you could say, if it happens to be that you know, Judaism adopts something and another religion adopts something, and you know, but Judaism has a Jewish reason, right, that it can trace back and defend it. So then maybe
so
it's more defensible.
Halacha.
What?
It's not like saying that a sermon actually goes against some particular halacha not to say a sermon.
Right.
It was never, like, if we had come up with on our own, we said, it's
That's
fine.
True, too.
But if we came up with the
anti people's argument was that only prayers are supposed to, you're interrupting prayers basically.
But I thought we often
We do also
We often gave drashot between services, and it usually comes between the shacharit service and musaf service.
Well, the services were implemented to be periods of study traditionally anyway. That's why we read like Rabbi Ishmael Omer and so on and during shacharit. And we're recreating something that was originally supposed to, so isn't the sermon like complementing that study?
Yeah, I don't see any personally speaking, I agree with you. I don't see any inconsistency between learning Torah at any point. You know, I mean, obviously there are points where it's not appropriate, like, you know, between Shema and Shemoneh Esrei, but I'm saying, like, I don't see learning as being an inappropriate activity for any reason during in shul.
But isn't halachic, like, is what we're talking about the separation, is it really a halachic issue? Because, like, we were saying earlier, it's not deraita, it's derabanan. So, like,
what do you mean?
Is it deraita? Because, like,
what is what deraita?
Separation of men and women.
So, what I was saying before is that, most of the rabbis are going to assume that it is a biblical issue. But even if it were rabbinic, we would still have to do it. So one of the arguments is, even if it's rabbinic, you still have to do it.
Because of the Rambam that we were reading just now.
Because of the Rambam and Rav Cook's argument, yeah.
And Rav Cook. So how is it the right, like, taking you guys to how it's the right, because of
the Zechariah
piece?
Yeah, because of, they're going to be different. We'll see some of the arguments exactly why it's biblical, but it has something to do with the fact that it was happening in the context of the temple. And we'll have to see why. There are different arguments for why, but it has something to do with that. Okay. So one of the approaches to how that source in Sukkah is the basis for Mechitza is to say that for whatever reason they decided that men and women had to be separate, that reason, the logic there should apply to any similar context where you know, there should be a certain seriousness, there's a certain decorum that's expected, right? So there is the Rambam wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. He actually wrote this quite a while before he wrote his Book of the Laws, Mishnah Torah. So his explanation there actually is kind of puzzling because it doesn't fit with the other two places where he talks about this Gemara. But in his commentary on the Mishnah, he says that the reason why men and women had to be separated, the reason why they made, he said, Michinim makam lanashim, a place for women, umakam gador lanashim, and a walled-off area for men, umakam hanashim lamala al makam hanashim, and the area for women was above the area for men. Gavoa mimenu, kedei sholo yistaklu anashim benashim. The purpose of that was so that the men would not look at the women. Okay, so there are a number of rabbis, mostly Hungarian rabbis, who felt that the whole purpose of mechitza was so that men should not be able to look at women. Mostly based on this Rambam. So what is the problem with men looking at women? So in Hilchot Kriyat Shema, in the laws of reciting Shema, it says that if certain parts of a woman's body are uncovered, or a certain amount of certain parts of her body is uncovered, then a man, even if it's his own wife, is not able to read Shema. And that's true for if a woman's hair is uncovered as well. And the Ramah explains obviously that that this doesn't apply to unmarried women. So that's one issue, is that maybe the problem is that there are certain ritual things that can't be done in the context of where men can see women uncovered in certain ways. And so if men were to see women, then that would be a big problem.
So the solution here was not to tell women to cover up, but to tell men
was to separate the men from the women in such a way that men couldn't see women. And actually this particular source makes a lot more sense in a shul than it does in the temple, because people actually are saying Shema, first of all. Second of all, which policy would you like better? Tell women how police how women dress, or just create a wall so that however women dress, they can come into shul, right? So the better policy, if you think that's the issue, is to just have a taller mechitza. The next source is actually a very interesting Gemara where it brings a couple stories about where there actually were rabbis who did look at women. Why were they allowed to look at women? Isn't it prohibited for men to look at women? So ends up justifying why those cases were different. But basically the point of that Gemara in source 11 is that there's also a separate prohibition, aside from the fact that certain ritual things cannot be done, such as saying Shema, when men can see parts of women's bodies. Beyond that, just looking at women, regardless of how they're dressed, no matter how well covered they are, for men to stare at women is inappropriate. And so that's another source for idea that why men looking at women would be a problem. Well, the first pasuk, not for the rest of it.
And it's because, like, they couldn't say it because they shouldn't say it, or because they would be distracted, and so they, like, actually couldn't say it.
Meaning mustn't or couldn't.
Yeah, like,
well, they're not allowed to. It's prohibited. Why is it prohibited?
Right.
So, it could be a kavana issue. It could be a you know, you're not able to have the necessary amount of intention to fulfill the mitzvah. But you could also say, I think another explanation for it is that it's just Shema in that context is just invalid. It's just not appropriate to be said.
Because it leads to kalot rosh?
It doesn't lead, it's not because it leads to anything. It's just like the juxtaposition of the things is not appropriate.
Original source.
Oh, no, I understand, but I think this view sort of kind of disconnects itself from Kal Rosh in a way, and just says the issue is looking, kind of. And what?
Yeah,
no, the uncovered hair is only a problem for married women. But right, other parts of the body apply equally to all people.
Statement that this one is just a halakhic prohibition describing the appropriate conditions for prayer, as opposed to talking about levity or flirting or whatever, because definitionally a married woman's hair becomes one of those uncovered parts of the body halakhically. But if we're talking about men being distracted, an unmarried woman would clearly fall more into the category of people we'd be worried about. So they do seem to be describing just appropriate conditions of prayer, as opposed to having that levity discussion right now in this source.
Right. I could say the opposite, which some of the poskim do, which is to say that since unmarried women normally don't cover their hair, them having their hair uncovered isn't as distracting as a married woman having her hair uncovered, because it's normally covered. Of course, you would have to know whether that particular woman is married or isn't, and how. Yeah, right. So I don't know how you know that in the first place, but let's not get into that. So, just to see how far this is taken, though, this view, which is mostly, again, like I said, Hungarian view, was taken so far that some rabbis felt that a shul had to be structured so that women were above men, and there could be no part of the men's section that was not covered by the women's balcony. so that if men could be viewed by women, right, obviously they could look up and see the women. So it had to be that no woman could see a man, no man could see a woman, because otherwise a man could see a woman. And they said, if the shul wasn't built that way, if the balcony didn't extend over the entire men's section, it was prohibited to go into such a synagogue, in some Hungarian rabbi's view.
You know, there were many historical, like, pre-reform movement synagogues that had narrow balconies.
I'm sure it's true, but maybe in this particular area of Hungary that wasn't the case. I don't know. Yeah.
From what I've seen in the blueprint in the show, we have a side-by-side pizza.
Yeah. So we're gonna discuss how we're gonna get around this Rambam. but basically, Monroe talk shuls that by and large don't have only balconies for women to sit in, don't follow this view, or don't necessarily have mechitas that entirely block view of women. Because there's two other Rambams that give a different reason.
is this the source for shuls that have a mechitza with a one-way mirror? Not as a balcony, but as something where the women can see him, but the men cannot see women.
If you held this view, the one-way mirror would help, although I've seen shuls that had a balcony with a one-way mirror, and they still put a lace in front of the one-way mirror because the one-way mirror isn't perfectly, one way.
The one shul I went to that had the one way, the women couldn't see unless they were on top.
Right. Right. So basically, the Chatam Sofer says that any tefillah that's done, with one's mind, also distracted by thinking about even one's own wife, would be totally invalid, and that's why mechitza is necessary. And so, I guess connecting, he was Hungarian, connecting Hirhur, connecting improper thoughts with the idea of that it's prohibited for men to see women, that's why that's the argument for why mechitza is necessary. So that's another view, but it's not gonna really be the view that we can follow if we're gonna have a mechitza that's this high or even this high. Because at the end of the day, if you can't see women at all, it's not gonna work.
Even if it's that high, if it's a lattice like this, then
right, and the lattice also. Or if there's any part of it that's glass, or it's going to be a problem. What? And for some of the views, the lack of a balcony for sure. So the more normative view, the one that's probably the most commonly followed, is that the problem with mixed seating is that there's a lack of seriousness when men and women sit together. There's some kind of lack of proper seriousness of the environment. It's not that they see each other, it's that they're sitting together. That's the problem, and it's a lack of seriousness. It's a kalat rosh. So, the Bach has this interesting opinion. He says that that you can't say the bracha of Shasimcha bim ono at a wedding if there's men and women sitting together in the room. Because of, he says, well, maybe there's a concern for hearer, but it also sounds like there's a concern of inappropriate thoughts, but it also sounds like the problem is that men and women are, it's not just that they're looking at each other, it's the sitting together, that inappropriate context. What?
What about the couple?
What? Well, how do you
avoid? How do you have them at the same?
Right. I don't know. Maybe it's that there's lots of them.
They need to be sitting together for the brachot.
They need to be sitting close, but not
So there are, you know, as we know, there are lots of Orthodox weddings that do have separate seating for men and women, even at the meal, and that Bach is the source for it. That's a chumrah that not everybody follows, and it's not one that we follow. But the principle, at least in shul, does exist. The Rambam says, so that here we have two Rambams that give a different reason for the separating of men and women. Rambam 14:15, in both places he says, why did they build this separation? Kedei shlo yitarvu elu im elu. Or kedei shlo yiyu meuravin. So that they would not be mixed. Because them being mixed, it's not that they would see each other, it's because them being mixed is a problem. There's something wrong with them being mixed. And actually, that is much more based in the original Mishnah in Midot, because the Mishnah in Midot says the reason that why they built these balconies was so that they would not be mixed. So the most famous opinion probably in the last 100 years about Mechitza, it's Moshe Feinstein. And that's his view. He says, "Yinei etzem hadin sh'af im ha'anashim hein b'tzad echad v'ha'anashim b'tzad acher asurin hein liyot b'lo mechitza hu li'afia niyataiti dina de'oraita." He says, even men and women sitting separately without a wall is, in my opinion, a violation of a rabbinic, of a biblical prohibition. The raya misukka.
Does that mean we lost the...
Here, just unlock it, please.
Oh, it's still recording. Okay, great. So he says it's biblically necessary to have mechitza. V'raya misukka, right? And the proof is from the Gemara in Sukkah we talked about already. He says, why? What's the issue? It is prohibited to add anything to the structure of the temple or to the courtyard. And so the Vitirates Rav, and Rav in the Gemara answered, that he found a verse to support the fact that it's necessary to separate men and women. It appears as Rashi explained. The Afshainu Ella Kra Vidivre Kabbalah. And even though that pasuk, that verse that supported that it's necessary to separate men and women is only from a Navi, is only from prophetic tradition, Yesh Lamelef Shapir, that's still a sufficient source for a biblical necessity of Mechitza, Shehare Lo Bahakra L'Chadish Yisurin, because a verse that is found in the prophets never comes to add on new prohibitions. So it must be reflecting on something that already existed, was already expected to exist. Rather, the verse is just telling us that when they have a hespin, when they have a eulogy, men and women have to sit separately. Yes?
Except that we learned Kavod Shabbat and Oneg Shabbat from Divrei Kabbalah, from a right, and those are Isurim, but they're not Doraita. They're not treated as, the prophet didn't come later to add a law, so it must have been originally, from, the same level as any other biblical law. We treat them as higher than rabbinic, but lower than a law from the Chumash.
Right.
He doesn't seem to be applying that logic here.
It's a good question. Think about it.
Regardless,
the prohibition to have in by Navi applies to both Asay and both Asay. That's a good point. I didn't think of that issue. But what he says is, what comes out of this is that in shuls where there are men and women praying, it's much better. It would be good if they had a balcony that women would be above. If there's any reason why it would be hard to have such a balcony, for example, I would say women don't want to daven on a balcony. Then they have to have an actual wall, so that it prevents them from coming to levity. It's not sufficient to have what's considered a wall in other contexts, like having open gates. You can't just have, like, you know, two of these on hinges and just have them, you know, open, and technically it's a wall because it's a doorway. That wouldn't be enough. It actually needs to be a closed wall. Because that wouldn't work for a wall in the Beit HaMikdash. And it would be biblically prohibited. And for the same reason, a 10 handbreadth tall wall from the ground is not going to work. In a klum, it's nothing. Indian kalat rosh does nothing to prevent levity. Because if you have a mechitza that's only 3.5 feet tall, or it's a little less than 3.5 feet tall, right? It's not very hard to have a full conversation. There's nothing stopping interaction. Even to touch, and there's nothing that's more, you know, levity than that. That's really considered mixed. It's enough to have it at shoulder height. Because we've seen that a mechitza is not for the purpose of preventing seeing. It's 18 tvachim, b'shabbat. And so that gets interpreted to be, you know, the standard interpretation of what Rav Moshe Feinstein is talking about is 5 feet. That's an accepted norm of what Moshe Feinstein says should be 60 inches high. Yes?
It sounds like it's going off of men's shoulder heights instead of women's shoulder heights. But all you really need to do is prevent one, and you've stopped essentially most conversation or frivolity.
If you prevent, if it goes to...
Right, if it's, like, shorter than the average man's shoulders, but it's taller than the average woman's shoulders, you're not going to be able to have an easy conversation between the two.
Okay, but that's the standard that he went by. Yeah.
Also, you need a line.
He's saying that some of the wall is 10 tefachim high, which normally is considered a lot of.
Yeah, he says that's not sufficient. Yeah.
Yeah. So would he also say that something like this, which is so normally if something is within a tefach, then it's considered a wall?
Oh, excellent question. Excellent question. Actually, has a tshuva exactly about that issue. So he was asked, what if part of the wall was made of glass? So he said that the top 20% of the wall or something like that could be glass or could be made of pieces of wood that are, like you said, you know, close enough together. Yeah, exactly. So that's why lattice often works, you know. But he does say that just having nothing here, even though you have the frame, would not be enough. And obviously, if he held the opinion that they shouldn't be able to see each other, so having glass in any part of it would make no sense. Yeah.
I am interested in
this. My humble opinion. I was trying to fit things in, so I didn't think that was, like, so essential, but I didn't want to mistranslate either, so. Yeah. All right, so another view, also mentioned Rav Kook, and by one of the original authors of a tshuva about Mechitza, the Maharam Shik, actually gets back to Andrea's point earlier, which is that we model our shuls on the Beit HaMikdash, and just simply the fact that the Beit HaMikdash had such a separation of men, a physical structure that separated men and women, says Rav Kook and says Rav Meir Amshik, that is, since we model the structure of shuls on the structure of the temple, so we should have the structure of a separation in our shuls as well. So that's source 17 basically says that the Navi says that God will have been a sanctuary, a mini sanctuary to them in exile. And Rabbi Yitzchak explains, what does that mean that God's going to be a mini sanctuary for the Jewish people? So that means that they're going to have mini sanctuaries with them in exile in the forms of shuls and Bate Midrash. So, following the logic that shuls are mini temples, so then they should have the same structures. So the Maharam Shik says, for that reason, just like there is a women's section, a men's section in the temple, we too are obligated, it is necessary for us, to have a separation between men and women's sections.
Why separation instead of being necessary to have a balcony?
Why not have a balcony?
Well,
so
no. Why would that not read as...
As Davka have a balcony.
Given the mission we started with.
So I guess, this is one of those things with interpretation of text. Okay. It's like, you can really manipulate any text to say whatever you want. That's the truth, right? So, because you can read a text extremely literally or extremely liberally. So the people who read it extremely literally would say, like you just said, and said, therefore you have to have balconies and men and women can't see each other. But Rav Moshe Feinstein and other people, and I think probably sounds like maybe Maharam Sheikh also, I don't know if he required balconies, didn't sound like it to me. What they had in mind was, the balconies weren't balconies and the men were below and they couldn't see the women. It wasn't practical to have like a wall like with, you know, women blocked off from all around and men in the center. And so women were just squeezed into an area between the courtyard wall and a wall. It made more sense to put them on a balcony so at least they could see what's going on, right? But the point was that there was a physical separation of a certain height. Right? Yeah, it's a little bit of a liberal interpretation, but it makes sense. It doesn't actually say that men, women were on top of the men, just they were above them. Yeah. Adam, you had a question?
Yes, why don't we see anyone applying these rules to Bate Midrash as well? I've never seen anyone argue it's not an Orthodox Bate Midrash if there's no Mechitza. But the same source for modeling a shul after that's a Bate Midrash also models Bate Midrash.
So first of all, there certainly are people who would object to having a mixed Beit Midrash.
Fair, but I've never seen them argue it's okay with the mechitza. Like, it's not in the same...
I've never seen them say that it's okay with the mechitza?
I've never seen someone say, so do it, but with a balcony. Or, like, it's never in the same way that people talk about shuls. It's usually more about whether or not men and women should be mixing in any matters of Jewish practice or social. Like, it's usually that's where the divide line falls about the Beit Midrash. Or about women learning Torah in general.
So why don't they bring up? Why don't they bring up that?
Why don't they model it after a shul? Say sure, have it mixed, but have the women learning separately and on top. Or like, it's not modeled in the same way.
Right. I don't know. I think for a lot of people, the assumption is that women don't learn, or when we think of Beit Midrash, it's just meant for men. And so, like, a lot of the people who would have been discussing this don't bring it up. And the people who are thinking about the context of a mixed Beit Midrash are already not, I think, of the same stature even to be writing these tshuvot, I think. Rav Soloveitchik is the only person who is of this kind of stature, who could have commented on that and didn't seem to have a problem with it. He literally built a school right here.
Right.
Where he thought it was fine. Yeah.
Well, two comments on that. One is there does seem to be this very interesting underlying assumption from the oldest of these sources that women were in synagogue, were supposed to be in synagogue, and were part of being in synagogue.
Yeah.
So one place in which you're getting a distinction is, as the rabbi said, women were considered to not be part of the Beit Midrash, period.
Right.
So you've got a description of what do we do about the fact that this is a co-ed environment. But also I'd say the school that Rav Soloveitchik built, he was very explicit in his era on the practicality of trying to achieve a fair education for girls, and whatever needed to be done to achieve that was, that's what he was looking for. And after his era, the school in fact had many discussions about girls and boys mixing and what to do about it, including assigning lockers on opposite ends of the school so that people didn't bump each other going to the lockers sometimes, and all sorts of debates, none of which had to do with inside the classroom, because it was firmly established by their founder that inside the classroom was a co-educational experience, and the only way to achieve that was to be fully co-ed.
Right, right. I mean, that's clear, but why didn't he defend it? Like, in terms of these discussions, I don't know. I mean, you could say that to talk about, mixed Beit Midrash as being a Christianization of the Beit Midrash is ridiculous. There's no such parallel in Christianity at all. I also don't think it applies to the logic that we're going to read soon. Which I think is the most Soloveitchikian of his arguments for why we need a mechitza. Rabbi Lam, in his article, mentions one more thing, which is, he says that the appropriate amount of kavana that someone needs to have during davening is not that there's levity or maybe everybody will act seriously, and maybe nobody will even look at each other, but in your mind, when you're sitting next to somebody you might be interested in, you can't possibly concentrate on what you're saying. You're not going to have the appropriate amount of concentration. He says it in ways that are clearly 1959, though. So that's why I put it there in case you're curious. It's too much to expect of a man sitting in feminine company to concentrate fully upon the sacred words of the sitter and submit completely to God. We are speaking of the deepest recesses of the human heart. It is there that prayer originates. And how can one expect a man's heart to be with God when his eyes are attracted elsewhere? We're speaking of human beings, not angels, and the halacha recognizes both the strengths and weaknesses of a man. It's simply too much to ask of a man that he sit in the company of women and behold their loveliness, and at the same time undergo a great religious experience. And what woman can concentrate on the ultimate issues of life and feel the presence of God when she is far more interested in exhibiting a new dress or a new chapeau? How can she try to attract the attention of God when she may be trying much harder to attract the attention of some man? When the sexes are separated, the chances for such distraction are greatly reduced. But I can't. That's 1959. I think 2017 Rabbi Lam probably would have spoken very differently. His views, like everyone else's, have changed in the many years that's happened since then. So remember, we're talking nearly 60 years ago.
Apparently none of the men in his congregation are at all lovely or attractive.
It's not to him, but that's. again, I'm not excusing it, but it just, we understand that we're reading something from 1959. Something that is convincing to me in terms of it, mechitza having this effect, but I'm not sure whether it was really the original intention of mechitza, is argued by Rav Soloveitchik on our last page. And he says that the entire concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Prayer means communion with the master of the world, and therefore withdrawal from all and everything. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as being an only friend from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. Behold, as the eyes of the servant look unto the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maiden unto the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look unto the Lord our God, until he be gracious unto us. So, this argument is that when a family is together, there's a certain security that a person feels when a man and a woman, especially if they are married, were to, if they were to pray together, there would be a certain security which they're not supposed to have during services, because they're supposed to feel a sense of existential loneliness and a desire to connect with God. And that very much fits into Rav Soloveitchik's general philosophy from pretty much anything you read from him, especially Lonely Man of Faith. So it's very much a Soloveitchikian argument. I don't think I could say that it makes sense to me that this was the original, that we could take this and say, oh, that must be what they were thinking in the Gemara and Sukkah, because it's definitely not. And so that doesn't fit. I don't think this was the original intention of Mechitza, but it does have that effect. It's an argument for why Mechitza is important, and maybe for how it's come to traditionally have the effect it's come to traditionally have. Maybe its dimensions and parameters have come to reflect this reality. And the way in which I could see that being the case comes out of the next source, which is actually not by Rav Soloveitchik, but it quotes something that happened with Rav Soloveitchik that I think might be related to what we just read. Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who is very much still alive, major posek in Israel. His grandfather was a major posek in the United States and was overshadowed by Rav Moshe Feinstein, but not because of his not for lack of greatness, just for lack of fame, and Rav Moshe Feinstein being, I think, a better and faster writer. But his grandfather was certainly a tremendous Talmid Chacham. So he himself also is. And actually his first two tshuvot in his series of responsa were about Mechitza, because he was a rabbi of a shul, and he visited a certain town in West Bank, and he noticed that instead of having a Mechitza that was attached to the ground, some kind of structure sitting on the ground, either attached or even wheelable, he noticed that it was hanging from, it was basically a curtain hanging from above, with more than, was above a certain height above the ground. Did you see how high? More than four tefachim above the ground. Okay. So this is not a problem. And he says that's insufficient. He says, your logic is, you're thinking about the Rambam, who says the whole problem is that men and women are not supposed to see each other. So as long as we have a curtain and men and women can't see each other, who cares? You know, who cares if they see each other's feet? Right? The point is they shouldn't see each other's bodies. They mostly can't see each other's bodies. The curtain is fine. You don't need to have a physical structure, just something that's blocking the view. That's enough. He says he believes that that is not correct, that Mechitza is based on the concept of what he calls Mivadalat Rushut, that it needs to separate men and women into two separate areas. Almost like they're in two separate rooms. They need to be in two. It can't just be a sections works. It doesn't matter. But the point is, it can't just be like a curtain that clearly isn't making it into two sections. It's making it just them not visible to each other. And he quotes stories that prove this, because he says, it's in his second tshuva, but I think it's the best proof he has for this whole thing. He says, So he heard from some very trustworthy group in America, Shehagrid Soloveitchik Shlita, that Rav Soloveitchik, Kama pa'amim hitir tefila b'mechitza bat yud tefachim b'shat tchak gadol. That sometimes Rav Soloveitchik, if there was no choice, allowed services to happen with a mechitza that was only 10 handbreadths tall, meaning about 3 feet, right? Obviously they could see each other. According to Moshe Feinstein, would not have solved the problem of interaction, right? And he goes on, he says, his grandfather also, right? Umasa haya kasher yitzakti mayim aide muaz Hagon, Hadir, Zakini, Tadik, sorry, Tadik Yisod Olam, Harav, Yosef Elio Hinken, that's his grandfather, Vishal Uhu, they asked him, Agave Bit Knesset Bit Sefer Tichon. So there was a high school, he's talking about in America, because his grandfather lived in America, there's a yeshiva high school, where Sh'amdu Habanim Mikadima, the boys are standing in the front, and the girls are in the back, and there was a 11 tefach tall wall between them, v'tfilot hamincha, during mincha, v'lo amar lo eser v'lo heter. He didn't say it was prohibited, and he didn't say it was totally permitted. Aval natan reshut l'rav ha-shoel, he gave permission to the particular person who asked, acharei she'yishtadel hagbiya ha-machitza, once he, as you know, he already tried to get it raised, if he sees it's impossible for that to happen, the shachnim l'hagbiya, to get them to raise it, v'in derech acheret she'yachol l'tpal sham, there's no other way to daven there, u'pashut she'tzrichu shnei reshut. It's clear that these two people, Rav Yosef Elio Henkin and Rav Soloveitchik, what did they fundamentally think the purpose of Mechitza was? Separating men and women into two separate sections. Because otherwise, what good does a 10 tefach wall do, right? It doesn't achieve the non-levity, non-conversation that Rav Moshe Feinstein was looking for. It doesn't achieve the non-looking at each other that the Hungarian rabbis were looking for. It doesn't necessarily help with concentration or any of that. What it does help with is it separates men from women into separate areas. So that's his proof from these stories that that's what they held. The reason why I think this is relevant to our Soloveitchik is it fits very well with the logic of the whole reason for, one of the reasons for Mechitza is that men and women should be separated so that they feel that sense of existential loneliness and then a desire to come closer to God. If they're in separate sections, that is achieved, even though it's only a 10 tefach wall. And so you could see how the different, you know, we went through eight different reasons to have a mechitza. You could see how each of the different reasons will have very different practical ramifications in terms of how you're going to structure a mechitza. If we're going to end up with the opinion that we'll accept the notion of Soloveitchik that it should be separate sections, and we'll follow the standard practice of Moshe Feinstein also, that it should prevent any kind of direct interaction, so then there shouldn't really be any difference between men being in the front or women and men being side by side. That shouldn't make any difference, because the issue isn't them looking at each other. It's not about what men can see on the other side of the mechitza. It's about their ability to interact.
Did any of them address at what age somebody has to sit on one side of the mechitza? Is it bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah?
So, I mean, I think definitely it should apply by bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. Probably it's a good idea to start earlier than that. In the same way that we do for every other major area of halakha, we start. There's an age of chinuch, which is around 6 or 7. That's probably the time that they should start getting used to the idea that they're davening on a particular side of mechitza. Yeah.
The opinion that mechitza only applies to your regular place of prayer is not covered by any of these. Under all of these opinions that we discussed, it seems at any time a minion gets together for your pickup mincha in the hallway or whatever, you'd want a mechitza. So why?
No, if you're basing it off of a synagogue, which is in some sense defined by temple, then it's not going to apply necessarily elsewhere.
Right. I mean, I guess like all this whole
synagogue construction,
This whole discussion was why this needs to be built in a shul and what is it trying to achieve. But once we're talking about prayer service happening outside of the context of a shul, so that's a whole nother ball game, because, you know, it's not that's not discussion anymore. So the reasons don't necessarily apply equally. Certainly the Mikdash Ma'at one doesn't apply, obviously.
Nor the loveliness.
What? Well, then, but right. So then the question, right, is
unless
like.
Unless they get less lovely if they're not in shul.
But like
I'm sorry, that was a really offensive phrase.
For Shiva Minyan and whatnot, like Zechariah seems to apply a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, and it even sounds like during the eulogy, just like sitting in the funeral. Yeah.
Is it a mechitza or just separate seating, though?
What?
Are they saying in mourning with a mechitza or just separate seating?
Well, usually in a Shiva Minyan, the women go in another room.
What?
In a Shiva Minyan, usually the women go in the kitchen or some other room. Usually, you know.
No.
Not everywhere.
Sometimes that's just based on the amount of space you've got in order to do your services in somebody's
don't.
Little house.
Yeah, a lot of times there's just no room in the room.
They do in some places.
Yeah. Happened to be in my parents' house, there was a big enough room, and we had like a couch that could be sort of like a separation. So.
Okay, but still the men and women kind of separated.
Yeah, it wasn't totally mixed, no.
Okay.
I think it's just become standard practice that if you're davening outside of a shul, the men and women still daven separately. But you don't necessarily have to construct a mechitza.
Right.
But you don't have, like, if you're having a minyan, you don't have, you know, man, woman, man, woman, man, woman.
Now what about like a wedding? Some people say you should have men and women sit, like for the chuppah.
Yeah.
Sit on separate sides. But there's never a mechitza. Or at least not in most modern Orthodox weddings.
There are in Israel.
Yeah.
In a modern Orthodox wedding, there's usually the mechitza is the pathway that they walk down to get to the chuppah. But it's not a. But then some people say, well, you're reading a contract. You don't need to have a mechitza at all. Like you could just sit all together.
Yeah.
So
that. So mechitza really outside of the context of a shul is really a whole other topic. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has separate tshuvos about that. And he actually says, because he talks about the issue that people started this idea that men and women shouldn't sit together at the meal, and he said no, they should, and then maybe people have shiduchim and.
Right. Yeah.
You know. But I want to emphasize that. I think I meant to say this, but I skipped over it. What Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, though it sounds strict, is actually radical, because he was radically breaking from tradition by saying actually it doesn't have to be a balcony at all. He got criticized, or a tshuvot of him defending himself for having written such a radical thing that it's fine for men and women to see each other during davening. So it has to be emphasized how radically liberal for his time Rav Moshe Feinstein was in what he wrote. Anyway, thank you very much for coming, and join us next time.
I have to press save.
Yeah.
Next time will be when?
Next time is February 10th. We're having a dinner, a Tu B'Shvat dinner, and a shiur about trees planted near a shul.
Yeah.
Thank you.